Hi, everyone. This is Natalie Gochner, and you are listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I represent the political center and have on the political left, Shireen Gourbani.
Hello, and listeners, we're so happy you stick with us.
And on the political right, John Dougal.
Hey, it's great to be with you, and it's great to see the rain.
Hey, have either of you ever sat in a U.S. Supreme Court, deliberation of any kind?
I've been in the chambers, but I have not sat there during deliberations.
Yeah.
No, I have not. How about you?
Have you been in the chambers, though?
I haven't been in the chambers. Okay. I've been outside to do a little protesting.
Yeah, I'm like with John. I've toured it and been there. One time, Senator Lee took a group of us in the back, and kind of saw where they dine and different things. But our president this week decided to go sit and watch as the hearing on birthright citizenship was being discussed.
This is a hot issue for him, so...
I think this has all sorts of drama associated with it because it seems quite performative, does it not?
Some may say it's performative. I think he's very interested in this topic, and he wants to see it live and what's happening. Now, he was only there for part of the argument.
Yeah.
He was there for his side being presented. So,
and then
he left for the other side.
Okay. To me, anything a president does in Washington where there's a motorcade and you go in and there's cameras, there's some aspect of it being performative.
Well, but then
and
that
especially
means everything
when it's never happened
does.
Before.
Yeah. I think that's what's interesting here. There has never been a sitting president, certainly, show up
for oral arguments.
So, this is pretty interesting. And I think. For me, I'm very concerned about this in general. I think birthright citizenship feels pretty fundamental to who we are as a country. So it's interesting, and I think
pretty established.
And unfortunately, I think it's in keeping with what are I would say the white nationalist tendencies of this administration to want to undermine this.
It's really two issues here. One is it constitutional? And another is it good policy? Because he signed an executive order to get rid of this when it's in the 14th Amendment.
Right.
So I think he's wrong on, I don't think he can do it by executive order, but you can debate whether it's good policy or not.
Yeah, well, and you get into this, and as I listen to the argument, and we're recording on Wednesday, so I listened to the argument this morning, at least part of it, a big part anchored on this concept of domicile. Where did somebody move? What was their intent when they moved? And there was lots of questions about, how do you discern intent? And, is it the mother? Is it the father? Both parents? How do you determine that? And trying to make a distinguishing issue about whether somebody was transitory, visiting temporarily, versus coming for permanent residency of some sort, and whether you can be an illegal immigrant or undocumented individual and have an intent to come here, but because of the law, you can't act on that intent and what this means. And if there's poor enforcement, does that imply something versus not? And
right.
My wife was like, man, these justices are clearly very sharp. Whether or not you agree with their outcome and their decisions, they are all... Nine of them are very intelligent individuals.
I agree with that. Shireen, we also have the president signing an executive order targeting mail-in voting.
Yeah.
He wants a list of U.S. citizens that are eligible to vote in each state, and then he wants to direct the Postal Service to only mail ballots to verified voters.
Yeah. So I feel like our state is a little bit on the front lines of fighting about this. We've had some interesting moves from our lieutenant governor related to voter rolls and trying to get access to what is fundamentally a state issue, right? Mm-hmm. So what I think is so concerning about this to me is it is very, very blatantly this administration showing its hand on trying to corrupt, disrupt, create chaos around our next elections.
Mm-hmm.
Not only the midterms, but also then I think, 2028. So I think we should be watching this very closely. And I feel like actually, John, we'll probably agree that we don't want to see federalization of our elections in this way.
Well, I think there's concerns with federalization. I will note that the Constitution allows Congress to designate time, place, and manner when they choose. But predominantly, you're correct. It's left to the states and the local governments. But the Constitution doesn't say the president by executive order gets to do this.
Right.
It's Congress gets to designate time, place, and manner.
Yeah.
Well, I sure like my mail-in ballot. You know what I like about it? I like to sit with it. I like to stew over it.
Yeah.
I like to think about it as opposed to going, waiting in line, going in behind a curtain, doing something, wondering if you're holding someone up. I just like to be present with my ballot and be thoughtful about it.
Yeah.
Well,
and it's convenient.
Right. And I've proposed, you might call it a hybrid. I don't have a problem mailing out ballots to folks. I would love to have them actually turned in person. Mm-hmm. But that means really short lines because you're not getting a ballot. You're not casting the ballot there. You're just walking in to turn it in and showing, you know, signing the roll when you go to submit it.
I will say that I don't think there will ever be a more interesting midterm election cycle than what we're entering into.
Oh, wow.
With all of this going on.
Well, I'm not an ageist comment, but you've seen some interesting times.
Yeah. Well, it's partly because of how the voting system's being challenged. It's partly because a president that's done really risky things.
Yeah.
And, you know, will the risk pay a reward or will he pay a price? And it's because Congress is already so divided and so close in terms of the representation. It can be a really interesting election cycle.
Well, and stepping a little bit away from that, the whole concept of, okay, the Postal Service gets to start filtering what does and doesn't get delivered and who it gets delivered to. I'll note that in a few weeks, there will be 3 John Dougals getting mail at my house because my son and his family will be moving in as they build a house. I largely get most of my parents' mail at my house so I can coordinate all the bills and everything like that and make
sure everything's
paid. So 3 John Dougals, and you know, hypothetically, let's suppose 2 are eligible and one wasn't. Well, how do you know which one's which?
Which one's which?
Wow. Yeah. Fascinating. John mentioned that we're recording this on Wednesday. Tonight, our president's going to address the nation. And he's obviously, we think, going to talk about the Iran war. It's hard for us because you're going to hear this after. There will have been a lot of news. But Shereen, what do you want to hear from your president?
Well, I think the American people deserved a justification for war in Iran before we started it. So at this point, I genuinely think he may show up tonight and be filing his grievances about the fact that his ballroom has been placed on hold. Like, I actually think that could happen. I don't know.
So he had a plan and that's going to change.
I think he's going to be scripted tonight.
Yeah, let's hope so. Because when he's not, it's getting worse by the minute. I mean, the arguments around this war, this engagement, which he's calling, what is he calling?
Military action.
Yeah, but he's calling it something else these days. Anyway, it's just, I hope there is some justification for this. Every day this goes on, it just feels like we are in an absolute web of chaos around reason, around what the end is, what if there's a way out. And I fear that what he'll be announcing is ground troops.
You know, he could take a more offensive posture, but I think he's going to basically start declaring victory. He's going to say, we've wiped out their Navy. We've wiped out all these capabilities. We've delayed, you know, degraded their ability to do this, that, and the other thing. And we'll be out of there within 2 weeks. Well, we got a little bit more left to do.
But this is the kicker. Okay. He's already somewhat declared mission accomplished. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like two more weeks. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you've ever seen that show, you know, Money Pit, which remodeling a house and it's two more weeks. But it's one of these things the American people are largely, I mean, one, they're sick of 47 years of attacks with Iran and their proxies. But they're also sick of wars in the Middle East. And it's, you know, okay. In and out is one thing to try and cripple them and move on and try and have some semblance of semi-peace or, you know, demilitarization in the Middle East. It's another thing when we get sucked into another Gulf War and it's an endless war without a good indication of what it's going to take to get out. And that's what I think a lot of Americans are going to want to hear. What is the exit strategy?
I think it's fair to say that, you know, Americans, I actually would challenge this. I don't think a lot of Americans are thinking about Iran's posture in the world and attacks. I really think that what Americans are thinking about is the fact that nationally gas is over $4 a gallon now, that they cannot afford health care.
In Utah. In California,
right.
It's even higher.
Yeah.
6 or 8.
And what we're talking about, right, is that lots of Utahns have lost health insurance. Lots of Utahns are struggling to make ends meet. And this president's asking for $200 billion to fight a war of choice. That is what I think Americans are sick of.
Yeah, that's interesting. So the president also got some other tough news. Let's do 2 more of these before the break. One is the federal judge has now blocked his construction of the White House ballroom. You mentioned that, Shereen. And then he also had a judge ruled that the executive order defunding NPR and PBS is unconstitutional.
Yeah.
So he's taking some losses.
So I will just say this on the ballroom. What I thought was interesting about this is I believe the judge said the ruling was unless and until Congress gives permission for the president to do this, he does not have the authority to do it. And I would honestly love to see our senators on record saying that a ballroom is a good use of resources in this time when Americans can't make ends meet. So let's take the vote. I'd love to see it.
I like the judge's quote.
The argument wasn't about the money. The argument was about that the president does not own the White House. The president is a caretaker of the White House. Congress is the one that gets to decide. So that was, as I understand, that was the legal argument.
Yeah.
It's ironic because the suit was brought on by the National Historic Trust for Preservation or some name like that. And it's already been destroyed.
Right.
I mean, I'm glad they're weighing in, but they couldn't stop the history from being, you know, dismantled.
Right. And then I think also, you know, finding that Trump's executive order to defund NPR and PBS, the public broadcast service, this is just, again, the behavior of this administration. They will just destroy. They will just take a big swing. Mm-hmm. And then we have to like kind of deal with the pieces of that when it is fundamentally not the responsibility of the executive to do this. And again, John, I feel like would agree. Like this is Congress appropriates these funds. It's Congress's job. Giving too much power to the executive is bad, especially when it's as absolutely insane as this one.
So, as you know, I have problems with executive orders, regardless of what party, what president.
I
mean, so, and when there's an executive order, it needs to be within the bounds of where the president either has the authority or where Congress has dictated it. But when it comes to defunding, this is where, you know, it looks like what Congress has done has stood, and it was just the president's executive order. But when I read the judge saying, oh, well, you know, this is going at free speech. This is where I look and go, wait, the government's funding this. So the government should be able to take the money away also. I mean, what it giveth,
certain
it can take
of
away.
The government.
So, you know, we can debate who has the authority to actually do it. But to make it sound like this is a First Amendment argument and therefore the government can't take money away.
Yeah, that's a good point. Hey, let's take a short break. Natalie Gochner with Shireen Gourbani and John Dougal. Stay tuned, everyone.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on Utah Public Radio. We love to hear from listeners like you. If you would like to send us a comment, email bsotapodcast@gmail.com. That's bsotapodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. Shireen Gourbani on the left.
John Dougal, enjoying the rain on the right.
And Natalie Gochner in the Political Center. This is Both Sides of the Aisle. Shireen and John, Governor Cox got the good news this week that the Forest Service is moving its federal headquarters to Salt Lake City.
Okay, tell me why this is good news.
Well, sometimes, you know, you hear things like that, you know, several months before and you hear rumors of it and then it becomes, but this caught me off guard. I did not expect this. I just think it's a huge deal. I like having...
Had you not heard this or you kind of heard it on and off, but it was like, okay.
Yeah, I had not heard it. And it catches my attention because most of our listeners will know, you know, 2 in every 3 acres in our state is owned by the federal government. There's only one state that has more.
And that's Nevada.
Yeah. The Forest Service is about 15% of our state.
Yeah.
But in some counties, I was looking it up, Wasatch County, this is where Heber is, it's 1 in every 2 acres. Utah County, a major metropolitan county, has 1/3 of its land owned by the Forest Service.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think it's a huge issue to our state, how it's managed, what it means. And I think having these federal people closer is so good for our state. They get to see us. They get to know us. And hopefully they get to make some changes that I would love to see some land trades come out of something like this.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, first and foremost, I'd rather we didn't have the federal folks. But if we're going to have them, I would rather they're out of D.C. and they're scattered around the nation to actually see the impacts of the decisions and the regulations that they make.
Yeah, to be closer. I can see some benefit of that. I will also just say that this, while we have a lot of it, it exists across the nation. It makes sense to me that this would be in the West. I can see, you know, some logic for that. I do believe this has come with major cuts to the Forest Service. So while, you know, we are maybe celebrating this, I am curious how many jobs have been eliminated as part of this. I know a number of them were reduced in the dozing, which I feel like it's April Fool's as we're recording this. I do think it's important to just like go back every now and then and remind ourselves that basically no money was saved in the Doge cuts. So there are significant strains on these kinds of organizations with, I think, mounting challenges, which are, I think, sort of captured in the fact of how happy we are to have this rain, the lack of snow, just the potential for fire. Forest management is critical to our survival out here.
Yeah.
Well, to me, that means harvesting it. We've pretended for generations that, you know, it wasn't healthy to harvest the trees, where in reality, it is healthy to harvest the trees and it keeps the forest healthier.
Yeah. Well, okay, then Cox also, our state is competing to have a federal nuclear campus in Tooele County. Again, I think this is a big deal. I don't know a lot about it, but I've always been of the opinion that every generation of leaders needs to be thinking about what are they leaving behind in terms of economic, you know, dynamism for people that follow them. Someone gave us Hill Air Force Base. You know, somebody helped secure the Olympics and had a successful 2002 Games. And this is the type of thing that current leaders can do in Tooele County that would create lasting economic wins for our state. I want to learn more about it.
Well, and to me, having a strong economy means
diversification.
Lots of energy, cheap energy. I mean, it's critical. I'm one of those all of the above energy sources. So to me, this is a important step. One of the challenges we have is, once again, going back to regulators in D.C. who have been a wet blanket when it comes to nuclear power.
Yeah. So I would say also interested in all of the above if we are using a critical thought-based matrix around what are the impacts in terms of long-term sustainability, how much will we have to subsidize, you know, these approaches, like, for example, how we subsidize coal. I think looking at things like, of course, I'm, you know, what stands out to me is the notion of what do we do with this waste? How does that impact our long-term environmental health? I think there's a really complicated history around nuclear in the West, right? When we think about the ways that citizens here were lied to and downwinders and kind of all of that. So I just hope that there's a lot of careful planning and thought and real consideration for what the long-term health and environmental impacts are as well.
Yeah. I'm going to just note, there's a difference between nuclear weapons and nuclear energy. So.
I know, but I think that waste is still something that's been quite complicated, and where exactly and how we dispose and store that waste has real ramifications that I hope that we're really thinking about.
I don't think we have a national strategy for it.
Exactly.
Yeah. Hey, so Prop 4 keeps coming in the news. Senate District 15, this is the district where they were able to take enough of the signatures off of the petition to make it so Prop 4 did not qualify to be on the budget.
Above a threshold in 26 of 29 Senate districts, and they did not make that.
Yeah, and you got a statement from Rob Axon, the chair of the Utah Republican Party, saying, "We had significant concerns, you know, about some of the tactics used to pull signatures off of it." This is really interesting to me because you think of the Republican Party as being so dominant, so in the majority, even powerful in this state, and they couldn't get this done.
Couldn't get it done. And I just love to remind people their anti-union efforts, supermajority Republican anti-union efforts, the signatures that were turned in over doubled what was required. Like, the number was massive and there just was no chance that they were going to be able to pull off that many signatures. But in response to that, the Republicans in this state, again, right, made it easier for those to go out and get people to pull their signatures off because they didn't like what happened. Mm-hmm. Now they're suffering the consequences of their own efforts to continue to control voters, yeah. You know, whatever. And I just have to say to Rob Axon, you're concerned about the tactics that were used to get these signatures removed. I could not be more concerned about the variety of lies I heard from individuals who were collecting these signatures. What they told people they were signing is not what they were signing.
So you think the tactics went both ways,
they sure
or just
did.
At least one way? Okay.
Well, I think I'm going to step away from this and go back to the broader issue of how Prop 4 was pitched originally, and it was pitched, and that was not the reality that turned out that went through the judicial system. And what we got from the judge in terms of the map that the judge adopted was atrocious from my perspective.
I know you got problems with it.
So let's go all the way back to how this thing originally started.
So anyway, gerrymandering is bad. Okay, where do we want to go next?
Well, you also have a lot of people changing their party affiliation to hit this April 1 deadline.
Yeah.
This is interesting. We used to, in this state, listeners, just think of this. We used to not have a closed primary on the Republican side. And I really like open primaries. Enough of a centrist, right, that I like to invite people to participate in the vote, however they want to do it. And I would say back in 2003 or so, 2002, the Republican Party closed their ballot. So you can only vote in a Republican primary if you're registered. And so now what happens is a lot of people register as Republicans, you know, do what they want to do, and then they get out of it. And I just think it's a lot of game playing.
Well, and lots of states, other states, whether it's whoever's in kind of the supermajority generally has a closed primary.
Right.
And stuff. This isn't something unique in Utah.
Right. Shereen, anything you want to say on that?
I would just say the Democrats still have open.
Yeah, you have open, right?
Open primary. So regardless of your affiliation, if you are interested, if you want to get involved, we certainly have, I think, a number of competitive and interesting races. But by the time you hear this, it'll be too late.
So I'm driving in my car, Salt Lake City, Utah. There's a press conference going on. I'm like, huh, what is this all about? And then I hear the word Ted Bundy. Oh. And then I realize, oh my goodness, there's Ted Bundy news being made in Salt Lake today. And this is this tragic.
And I'm going to say you're old enough to know this. And you were raised in Utah. I wasn't raised here.
Yeah.
So
yeah, tell us.
This was a murder that happened in 1974. So I'm, 10 years old.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, it was a case that they didn't have closure to until just this week.
Just this week.
50 years later, where they were able to do the DNA match. And how interesting for the, I think this is in Utah County. So let's say the Utah County Law Enforcement Agency to put this into the national database and get a ping in Florida, which is where Bundy's, DNA code is, and realize that they've got closure for this case.
Now,
so
this,
sad.
So sad. And my understanding is that it's suspected that Bundy potentially killed up to 8 young women mm-hmm. in the state at that time. 5 they were certain about. I think this was one of the 5 they thought that it was mm-hmm. Bundy and
right.
he had confessed to it. But really to have this kind of closure, I think, is so important for families.
Yeah, modern thing. I think the name of the victim is Laura Ann Aim.
Yeah.
So really tragic, but happy to see that they've got at least some semblance of an end to this saga. And I just tell you that as a young gal, Bundy had things. He had crimes that were committed in the high school that I ended up attending, the malls that I would go to, and as a young girl, you knew that name. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's awful.
Well, I know that we're kind of doing a lot of speculation here today, but I read it's general conference this weekend. And anything that's on the horizon, do you anticipate?
You want to go first, John? You want me to?
Go ahead.
Predictions?
Go ahead.
I'm an active member of the faith. Yeah, I love conference weekend. Why
there
do
will
I
be
love
8
it?
8 hours of conference. So,
I can tune in.
I'd love it because it's just a time to pause and stop and listen to our leaders share things with us. What am I looking for? Inspiration. And we've got a new prophet, so that makes it fun to kind of learn. President Oaks distinguishes himself as being a former Supreme Court justice, a former university president. He's a very bright person, and he is pioneering a new civic theology that I kind of call mutual accommodation. And I'm super excited. I don't think that's what this weekend will be about.
Yeah.
But this is we have a prophet that's very astute when it comes to public mm-hmm. affairs.
I think you will hear a lot about Jesus Christ, since this will be Easter.
Easter.
You will hear a lot, I think, about peace and love and finding common ground. And I think you will probably hear some, maybe not as direct, but things that you might read into, wars and stuff like that around the world.
Yeah.
And trying to find peace among, warring peoples and how members of the LDS faith should be seekers of peace and looking for service and how to provide service to others. I think you might hear a little bit about the Constitution, partly because it was an important document and America's 250th birthday. You might hear some references to that.
Yeah, interesting. Any chance we hear them make a public statement against an ICE facility right in their backyard?
That's an interesting one. I don't think you'll see that.
No, because this is speaking to a global audience.
Yeah, but I
and that's
but
too
I do think
centric.
Yeah, but I do think that you might have some inferences about caring for,
the stranger.
Uh huh. Could be. What's it like for you, Shereen?
So I've been.
Okay, when you were an elected official, they invited you?
Yeah, I got to go.
We all know where the elected officials sit and wonder what they're thinking as they're there, especially if they're not a member of the faith.
Attend.
Well, I feel like I have to score an invite. No? You got to get invited. No?
We can get you there, Shereen,
okay,
if you want.
Well, I'll say, I've spent a lot of time in Catholic spaces. And one of the things that I always loved, even though the religion never, we didn't quite ever get it together. I really loved the music and I really love ritual and pageantry. And I do think that there's a level of just a sense of peace and comfort that comes in something that feels big and like uplifted. I don't know, spiritual,
mm-hmm.
religious.
Mm-hmm.
So there were elements of that that sat with me, mm-hmm. that I appreciated. I think it's some things living here that I wish every Utahn could see at some point.
Yeah, we need more interfaith interaction, for sure. Hey, great conversation. Natalie Gochner with Shireen Gorbani and John Dougal. Our program is produced by Anthony Scoma. Thanks, everybody, for listening.